Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around, you're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we are here with the one and only Webb Wilder. Webb's an artist originally from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. He's currently living in Nashville, and he had a stop through Austin during the 1970s. His band, Webb Wilder and the Beatniks, have been cranking out their own kind of roots, blues, rockabilly, Americana, and Southern rock and roll since 1985. His 10th album, Powerful Stuff, came out early this year, and one of the guest stars on this on his record was David Grissom, who I interviewed in episode number 169. I was really fortunate. I got the opportunity to meet Webb at NAMM. He's a hell of a nice guy and an amazing player, and thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time, Webb.
Thank you, Craig. I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate you having me. I've got to correct you.
Please.
You did something that has been done a million times, so don't feel like the Lone Ranger. It's not Beatniks, it's Beatniks. Like, it's an albatross of a name because it's problematic, but it's Rednecks meets Beatniks. Beatniks.
I probably failed at that because I'm from the Bronx, and the redneck thing probably wouldn't come out of my mouth. So thank you.
Well, I just think the commonality of the term beatnik takes over any knowledge of what it really is. And yeah. I wish I had made my peace with, I loved the name when we had it many years ago, but it's always been problematic.
No, it's great. Webb Wilder and the Beatniks, everybody. So thank you for correcting me. I appreciate that. Hey, well, first of all, congratulations. 10 albums. Is you don't hear that ever, but especially nowadays, that's a pretty large catalog of music. And, you know, we kind of just talked a little bit before we came on the show and went live. What like motivates you to keep making records? It's tough in the industry climate that we're in with, you know, they're not being bought the way they used to be.
Well, that's true. They're not being bought the way they used to be. But what I've noticed, it's funny because, you know, it everything changes faster than it used to. So I appreciate you saying that, but I went 9 years without making a record one time, and it was a mistake because what I noticed is that everybody else was churning out something or another, and you've got to do it to keep a media presence and to keep the public interested and just to remind the world that you're still there. So I always say, yeah, you need to make a new album so you can get some new gigs so the old fans can come and ask for the old songs. And that's what happens with the Rolling Stones on down. You know, the Rolling Stones make a new album, and here and there, you know, there are some good things on those records, but they can't play any of them. And you know, it's a they'll cry all the way to the bank, of course. But I mean, you know, they got so many hits. But that's what I notice. And I also noticed that up until just recently, this thing of what you're talking about with the sales and all is pretty recent. Much younger bands have many more albums than me. Like the Drive-By Truckers, you know, have been together a lot of years now, but they seem like a young band to me. And, you know, Prince Charles told me never to drop names, but I was talking to to David Hood, one of the world's most iconic bass players, you
Muscle
know, about
Shoals.
His son's band, Patterson Hood, the Drive-By Truckers. And he told me they had like 14 albums, and that was like 3 or 4 years ago, you know. So I've been at it 30-something years and only have 10 to show. So that averages out about one every 3 years. And the industry has usually up till now mandated that you do one every year. And you look back at the Beatles and the Stones, they were touring their asses off and putting about two out a year. And they were the greatest albums ever made. You know, you're in awe of some of those people.
Yeah, man. But I wouldn't sell yourself short, man. 10 albums is great, whether it's, you know, 15 or 30 years, man. That's a big collection. It's a lot of work and a lot of effort. So,
well, it really was. And I think it's high quality stuff. The only thing I lament is the sonic character of Hybrid Vigor. You know, it was made all analog, but it kind of sounds digital anyway to me. It has that 80s sonic character. The performances and the songs I'm really proud of. But other than that, I'm really proud of them. And, you know, there are only 10 albums, but there are a lot of tracks. There are a lot of songs. So the catalog is actually pretty big.
Definitely, man. The last record, Powerful Stuff, the most recent one, that's mostly or all previously unreleased tracks. I was curious what prompted you to release them all of a sudden.
Well, it's all 100% previously unreleased tracks. The only thing that might make that confusing to someone is that you might see a title that you've seen on another one of my albums, but they're different versions. For instance, we put out an album in 96 that I'm very proud of that to this day has been very under discovered by most people, called Acres of Suede. And there's a song called Lost in the Shuffle. It's a really good version. There's a song called No Great Shakes. It's probably the version. But we found previous versions of those that are radically different. And on Hybrid Vigor, you know, there's the Sam and Dave cover, Ain't That a Lot of Love. We've put out a radically different version of that that has David Grissom on it. You mentioned him earlier. And we're able to go in there and remix it and make it sound really good. And it's got horns. It's got Willie Weeks on bass. It's got David Grissom. None of that is on the other Ain't That a Lot of Love. Hmm. And like the version of No Great Shakes on Powerful Stuff has different lyrics. It's from a completely different session, different arrangement. And Lost in the Shuffle, that's a completely different session, different studio. And it has horns, and it has Al Kooper on organ, you know. And
wow.
So, and then everything else is a title that's never been out there before.
That was pretty big. That was this very subtle name drop there.
Yeah.
Like I said, we met at Summer NAMM. I think you played with the Time Jumpers, correct?
Yes, and that was the second time I've done it, and it was a gas, as it was the previous time.
What was that? I mean, those guys are pretty powerful musicians. I mean,
they're great. I mean, you know, there are kind of two high profile Western swing bands, the Sleep at the Wheel and the Time Jumpers. I mean, the Time Jumpers are just great. And the funny thing is, the reason I got to do that, they're all really nice guys too, but it had nothing to do with them. It was Tom Spalding, who's the artist relations guy with D'Addario. And that's a big D'Addario shindig that kicks off NAMM every year. And as you noticed, it's great. They have free barbecue and everything. And so Tom asked me if I would sit in with the Time Jumpers year before last and do a song. And I did. And it went really well. And so this year he said, would you do two? And I said, okay, sure, I will. And then I got up there and I had kind of a senior moment and blanked on the last verse of Don't Roll Those Bloodshot Eyes at Me. And then played an awful solo and remembered the words and finished the song. But people seemed to really love it.
That was great, man. So when I got there,
you know, Kenny Sears is one of the fiddlers, and he's just so authentic and great, you know. And I got there that night, and he said, hey, Webb. And I thought, great, he knows my name. You know, I'm impressed. And but then when he introduced me that night, he said, and now Tom Wilder.
Tom Wilder?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But he's still really nice. Like, you know, he didn't do it maliciously or anything. And so it was a gas playing with him. And I got off stage and my old sound man that used to work with me, he said, man, that was great. This is what you ought to be doing. And he said, do you sit in with these guys all the time? I said, no. You know, this just happens when it happens.
Wow. Well, also, it sounds like if you live long enough, you get another song every year. You'll be sitting through the whole set.
Yeah, I'd love it. I'd love to do more things with them because I could get better at it. And Andy Reese, actually, is one of the guitar players, actually is a friend of mine. And I'd like to take lessons from him. It doesn't really show up in my music, but being such a rhythm lead kind of guy, I love Eldon Shamblin's Western Swing rhythm playing, where you're doing like a chord change on every beat and walking bass lines in between and all that super unique stuff. And you know, there's sort of a handful of people who can do that. Andy can do that in jazz and more.
Yeah, he's a brilliant player, and he's got a hell of a great collection of vintage guitars, man.
Oh, I know.
Really, really good
guy. I know, man. We bond over that, too. I don't have – I used to have some real .NEC 335s and stuff, and I don't. And he has a real nice one that I envy him having.
You're originally, as I mentioned in the bio, from Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Yeah, born and raised.
Which I know only from Warren Haynes' song, The Hattiesburg Hustle.
I don't know that I've heard that. I got to hear that.
Yeah, it's a cool tune. But what was your childhood like growing up there?
Well, you know, as you're experiencing your childhood, you're sort of, or I don't know how yours was, but how, you know, you're sort of like caught up in like real low horizon things, you know, like, who's the prettiest girl in the class and why doesn't she like me or something like that, you know? So at times, it was a small town, you know, and it seemed kind of like boring, you know, but looking back, man, it was pretty great. Because it was really more like a medium sized leaning towards small town, big university there. They have a military installation there called Camp Shelby that sort of flourishes in the summer and the town expands because the National Guard guys are in town. And, you know, you have the Deep South thing, which is different than the South South. Like I'm here in Nashville. It's cool, but it's not like the Deep South. So it's really an Afro-Celtic culture down there. Okay. And of course, in the 60s, everything's great. You get the media, you know, you get TV, you get radio, the music's great. And the garage band boom was on, you know, by the time I got to junior high, there were a million bands and there was a teen center we could play at and guitar stores downtown. You could ride downtown for a dime on the bus and look at new Gretches in the case packed in tissue paper. You know, there was a zoo and had a real loving mom and dad, lived in a tiny little mid-century modern kind of house. And, you know, it was just pretty cool. But we thought at the time, like, man, it's really boring. There's nothing to do here. But it was kind of and you'd always think it should be like Leave It to Beaver, where everybody's wearing a sweater and a windbreaker and walking on sidewalks, you know. and the media sort of tells you that if you're a Southerner, you're an idiot, you know, and you have to deal with all these media induced concepts, despite the fact that you gave the world William Faulkner and Elvis, you know. So there's all this weird stuff that being from Mississippi that even somebody from Mississippi can't explain. But that was a long winded answer. But it was kind of great, really.
That's cool. I think boring is good, actually. Now that I'm older, I think.
Exactly.
You know, honestly, I think boring is good. It's like no.
Yeah, there was a lot of time to have a big imagination, and yeah. I certainly did. And Bobby Field, this guy I grew up with, who had a lot to do with my life and career, his imagination's even bigger.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
No.
Okay. What kind of work did your folks do?
Well, my mother had been really a product of the 40s and a girl who had grown up poor in the country and had tried to better herself in the office world and stuff and liked the business world. And times being what they were, when my father was able to insist that she not work, he did. And I think it kind of goofed her up. I think she was never really comfortable being stuck off in suburbia as a housewife. But my father had a furniture store. And I always loved the idea of the small businessman and the independent businessman, you know, because I grew up around that. And he was a merchant, you know, he had a furniture store and he had a bunch of brothers and sisters. And his two brothers lived about 100 miles north in Jackson, Mississippi. Each of them had their own furniture stores.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. That's really cool, actually.
Well, it's kind of not all that hip. But, you know, what's funny is that I loved all my relatives. I love them all to this day, but I kind of thought, well, they're all square, you know, and I'm here watching a lot of TV and I'm just inclined toward music. I don't know why, because my parents weren't music at all. And I thought, well, there's nobody really musical or hip in my family. What I didn't realize is that right about the time I was born, my Uncle Willard's wife, my Aunt Lillian, closed her record label, which was funded by the furniture store. Which proved to be iconic. You know, Willard and Lillian McMurray had Trumpet Records in Jackson recording Elmore James, Sonny Boy Williamson,
hillbilly
artist Jimmy Swan, and many others. And wow.
That's pretty.
But I didn't even know that. I was already playing in garage bands when I found that out because my parents didn't listen to Elmore James, you know.
What did they listen to? Was there music going on in your house?
A little bit, because I was a spoiled brat with no boundaries, so I could watch as much TV as I wanted to and stuff like that.
That's what happens when you're an only child. I think pretty frequently you have a lot more leeway with stuff.
Yeah.
So talk about that then. Like, how did you first get tuned on to guitar, and what made you pick it up, and like, how did you become you as far as music goes?
Well, that's a good question, and I get asked that a lot, so I've thought about it a lot, and I'm a little foggy eye on it. I was always inclined toward music and show business and being kind of a dreamer and, you know, would always sing and like to sing. And loved Roy Rogers, you know, and I loved Western stuff. And so Roy Rogers to me had it all. He had the girl, the horse, the, you know, the guitar, the music,
the girl wow, and the horse,
the clothes, the clothes, man, and the hat, all of it. So, and I got to meet him later on, which is another story. But so there's even a picture of me when I'm 5 or 6 holding, I would love to have this back, a plywood Roy Rogers guitar, but I knew nothing about playing it. I'm right-handed. I'm holding it left-handed, you know.
There you go.
so that didn't really click. So I was friends with these two older guys that lived nearby. They were 1 year older than me, and they were best friends with one another, and they each had cheap guitars. Because the Beatle thing had happened. The whole music thing was happening. And I'm sure I would have asked for a guitar, and maybe I had, but it seems like I hadn't. And my dear mother, who was sort of a shut-in and was very oriented to like ordering things on the phone, you know, right down to her groceries at times. And she said, I guess she could just tell I was interested in these guys' guitars. And she said, would you like a guitar? And I said, sure. And so, you know, she got me a plywood silver tone acoustic for Christmas. I was 12. And then I would go over to the house of this guy in high school who was in a semi-successful garage band, you know, high school band, and pay him $1. And he'd take a pencil and he'd write out the words to folk songs, like Tom Dooley was the first song, 2 chords. And then he'd write the chord change over the word where you changed. And he'd show me the chords in the Mel Bay book. You know, this is the pick. And so it was always kind of singing and playing, you know, and I how I learned. And then, of course, I wanted an electric guitar before I was ready for one and got a cheap electric guitar. And then my aunt had a pawn shop and I got a Gibson Falcon amp, which I still have.
Wow. That's
but cool. I still had the cheap guitar. So I show up for the first band rehearsal a few years later in junior high, and I had the crappiest guitar. There were 3 guitar players and probably the least chops. And the other guys had Gibsons. And so I became the bass player. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing I have in common with Tom Petty, is that sort of being from the South, bass player origin, you know. And I bought my bass, which I still have. And believe me, there's a lot of great instruments I've owned that are gone. But I've still got my bass. I bought it as new old stock in about 68, begged my parents to buy it. And it was a greatly reduced price, which back then nobody discounted gear, really. But it was at a salvage store, believe it or not. It was a Fender bass. And the salvage store usually had water damage, fire damage stuff. But they must have bought out a bankrupt music store, because all the gear was perfectly fine. They had Vox, Gibson, Fender. And they wouldn't buy the case. And the case was half price too. But finally, I talked them into it. I got the last case. And so I didn't want to play bass, but I learned a lot by playing bass. And, you know, just kind of went from there. Then later I got, for $175, I got an SG-shaped Les Paul Jr. because I had missed out on the Leslie West one, the single cut Sunburst one at the local music store, $150. I was like, let me go get my money. And I begged, borrowed, and stole, and came back with the money, and it was gone. By this time, I'm like maybe in high school.
Wait, do you still have this guitar?
No. I had another SG-shaped Junior. No, I've got an old refinished single cut, and I've got an Epiphone Coronet, and they're nice. But I wish I had it, of course. I've traded it in Austin when I later went to Austin. But
wait, hold on. What's a coronet?
The one you really wanted, like Leslie West, you know, was $150, and I missed out on it. And so I was talking to this guy that lived around the corner from my girlfriend. You know, a lot of years had passed. I was in high school by now. And I said, well, that was $150. He goes, well, I got one that says Les Paul Jr. on the headstock, but it's shaped like an SG. I said, well, what do you want for that? And he goes, $175. I said, well, it's not worth as much as the other one. He goes, take it or leave it. So that was my first name brand 6-string electric guitar.
Wait a minute. You said something about an Epiphone Coronet. What is that? What you said? Epiphone Coronet?
Yes. Yeah, it's a great guitar. It's a 61, 3 on a side, you know.
Wow. Very cool.
I got it from Dave Henson out at Killer Vintage. And I had seen my first English band I ever saw was Mott the Hoople. Mick Ralphs was playing a guitar like that. His might have been a Dwight, but it was either way. It was that model.
He was a great guitar player, man.
He had 2 high watt half stacks. This was a year or two or more before all the young dudes, and they weren't really drawing. They were trying to headline the warehouse in New Orleans, and it was great.
Wow. So once you started playing professionally, right, or throughout your career, because you've been at it a long time, and you know, to do that alone is like a massive congratulations.
Well, thanks.
What are some of the bigger obstacles that you've had to overcome throughout this journey, like either personally, music related, business related?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of them, but they're sort of garden variety things, I guess. I think the biggest obstacle I've had to overcome is myself. You know, I think one thing I've learned is that as a young person, I didn't know myself. You know, I mean, it's like anybody else. You got to be around somebody for a while before you know them. Yeah. And, you know, so I think, you know, in my case, I along the way, I had to overcome my own lack of humility, you know, to face a lot of faults of my own, you know, and I had to overcome, I don't know, you know, what have I overcome? I had to live with, you know, and accept, you know, and get past some things, you know, divorce, alcoholism, all sorts of things. So, and just kind of, finally settling down into you are this, you know, I think I grew up thinking there's no way you could be in show business. There's no way you could play music and be successful at it. So I kept trying to not do that. In my 20s, you know, I tried to sell furniture for my uncle and do all sorts of things like that. So I kind of got off to a slow start. But ultimately, you are who you are. And, you know, Tom Petty once said when they were asking him about what does it take to play music, he says it helps if you can't do anything else. And there aren't a whole lot of things I can do. I can talk, you know, even better than I'm speaking to you. I could really, you know, get down on my speech. So I've done a lot of announcing and DJing. You know, I've got a radio show now and things like that. And that's been good to have at least one more thing you can do. But, you know, I don't know if I'd had more of a greater inclination toward acting, I might could have done it. But I'm ultimately, I think actors who are really great either are like Marlon Brando, where they just are so great, they don't even have to love it to be that great at it, or they love it like I love music, and thereby they're compelled to do it. I don't love it like I love performing and playing music. And I've always said my spirituality is caught up in, you know, when they were talking about the majesty of rock in Spinal Tap, it wasn't a joke to me. When I hear great Badfinger stuff or something, it's majestic to me.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny what you said, a few things that you said that I want to touch on. You said about your voice, like I meant to tell you the first thing when I met you in person, I didn't notice because we didn't really spend a lot of time. It was pretty fleeting. I think you were on your way out, and I thought it was your wife or a woman that you had to go or something. But the first thing I thought of when we were talking, I'm like, man, this guy's got a great voice. You know, I could listen to your voice like all day long, man. And when you said divorce and alcoholism, you're just checking off the music boxes of.
That's what I mean. It's not really that unusual.
But it's not easy either, and they are obstacles. I haven't had any addiction issues, but I had a divorce many, many, many years ago, and it's. Especially if you have kids, it's one of those things that even though you're happy about it, man, it doesn't go away. The whole, I don't know, for me anyway, getting married is a natural process, even though you don't know what the hell you're doing. But right. Getting divorced is a very unnatural process, and unwinding that whole thing, for me at least, took a number of years to like land on your feet and to, you know, just figure out, figure stuff out, you know?
Well, and people will tell you that when you're going through it, but you don't believe it. Like they'll say, well, it'll take you 5 or 10 years, you know, but I tried to rush into some other relationships and things that thank God those women wouldn't have me because it would have been disastrous.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Well, I've been with my wife 26 years, so everything worked out with me. So I'm very grateful for that.
Well, you should be. Dana and I've been together a number of years now, and I'm very grateful for that.
Tuition, as far as like mistakes that you make, we all make them in our careers. I was curious if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes you might have made musically and the lessons you might have learned from that.
Well, let's see. A lot of them, I mean, I'd be the first to make a list of what I think I did wrong or what's not up to snuff about this or that thing. But a lot of them, you know, because I'm the guy who's really beating myself up via the tyranny of the coulda, shoulda, woulda, you know.
Yeah.
But in the last year or two, I've started realizing, wait a minute. You know, you start thinking like what you would have done different. It's like, it's almost like wishing you had a smaller nose. You know, it's like, well, if you've been born with a smaller nose, your nose would be smaller, you know.
Right.
And so the only way I could have done my life different is if I hadn't been me.
Yeah, right. You get,
you know, because yeah. I can pretty much I've gotten to know myself.
Yep.
And I know why I became the person I became, you know, my family of origin, on and on and on and on. I don't know why I was born with an inclination toward music. I think a lot of it was just fueled by media and unrestricted leisure time, you know, whereas my parents might have been that too, had they had a radically different non-depression World War II, you know,
yeah.
youth, you know, so they might have had underlying talent that was undiscovered. But no, I wish I had been the guy who had a little more confidence in my guitar playing early on and had practiced more. But I was always surrounded by guys who were quicker on the uptake to be able to hear things on record and play them just like the record. And to this day, I'm not that guy. I can hear changes. I can play like me. I think I can play with a lot of soul and a lot of feeling. And I can put it all together in a package deal that comes out like me. And I realized that's an asset, because then you kind of have a style.
Yes.
But but I was never that guy. And so I don't know. And I guess I wish I'd been more open to, you know, actively seeking out lessons and things like that. Just really, it all kind of gets back to self-esteem. I wish I'd had more, but that gets back to, well, you were you.
Yeah.
You know, you had to achieve some of these things, and youth is wasted on the young, you know. So, you know, hopefully some wisdom comes with age.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. I agree with much of what you said as far as like, man, if you're happy with where you are now, it all worked, even though you made the mistakes, kind of, you know?
I really do wish that I had achieved greater success early on, for the simple reason that things could be a little more comfortable now.
Sure.
You know, like you envy Keith Richards and Paul McCartney being able, what they're able to do at their age. They've got, you know, if B.B. King hadn't had a lot of people around him to take care of him, he wouldn't have been on the road that long. So it's hard to get out there in a van and sit in it for hours on end and miles on end, and then get up and rock and then try to go to sleep. You almost have to sleep on cue, you know, after the show, and get up and do it again sometimes. But I'm still grateful for my fans, and that the music we did make was good enough that there's an enduring appeal of some of it, you know. That's good back to, you know, you think, well, you want to do new music, of course, you know, and you're always told you need to grow and change and do new music. And I always say, yeah, so they can come and ask for the old songs. But what if they didn't like the old songs?
Yeah, then so, you'd be in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, I think we all tend to be our own worst enemies, but the frame of reference of Keith Richards and Paul McCartney is probably not a good one for whatever that's worth.
Well, you know, I'm just not going to be able to tour at half their level, you know. So, I mean, they've got a little more comfort, you know, although they are, you know, McCartney has obviously got great genetics and has taken great care of himself. Keith has got bionic genetics.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Has not taken care of himself.
There you go.
I just wonder if, despite the smoking and drinking, Keith must work out or something. He always seems like he's got a lot of strength in his arms, you know, and flexibility, and he gets down on his knees on stage and does all that stuff.
I think that's just good genetics. I mean, I think I read his bio a little bit. Is basically, I think, gypsies, and he happened, you know, it's just had great genetics, and some.
Well,
guys,
Woody
is
for sure gypsies. Woody's got, you know, that Romany culture. Albert Lee has gypsy blood. That Romany culture is throughout Europe, and Woody looks like an Apache or something, you know, and he water gypsies. He was the first one born on land or something, but he's a fascinating guy. He's one of my main men. Keith has got some French blood, like that Dupre grandfather that, you know, you've read about, that wouldn't let him play the guitar and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, he's got it. But Woody really was, I don't know that anyone is a bigger Faces fan than me. And that was a life-changing thing. I saw the Faces in 71. And, you know, I'd been playing bass. And Ron Wood didn't play guitar that heroically. You know, he was really a rhythm lead in the early days. He was a rhythm lead guy in the Faces. And it was a more accessible, to me, way of understanding how he played, you know. And I always gravitated from that point on, really, from that point on, and hearing Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, you know, which is when I had the SG Junior, you know, to the Chuck Berry kind of thing. And so Dave Edmunds would, my default rhythm setting is probably that monkey beat, Dave Edmunds, Raka Raka thing. And so Woody's been a champion of me, and I like his playing in the Faces better because he's had to do a non-Woody thing, because Keith is the Woody type player in the Stones, you know. So like, I never dreamed I would meet anyone famous, you know. I grew up in 1905 Fuller Street, Hattiesburg, Mississippi, you know, and it's been interesting, you know. So I love the Faces, and I've met some of my heroes that I wish I hadn't met, you know, but I've met some that are fantastic and wonderful and kind and witty, and like Nick Lowe and Ian McLagan. I never dreamed I would know anyone that was in the Faces, and I got to be buddies with him, as a lot of people did.
Wow.
He was the kind of guy. And he's, and I was talking to him about that thing, and he goes, well, Woody was a rhythm lead player, and when he got in the Stones, that job was taken.
Like, there you go. Wow. Anybody that, any cool experience that you can talk about, or interesting story about any of these, the any of your heroes that you met, without, you know, being gossipy or, you know.
Well, with those two guys, they're all positive, you know. I met Nick Lowe as a fan in a record store in Austin, and met Dave too in about 77. And they were doing an in-store thing, and Rockpile was doing a concert that night with Mink DeVille and Elvis Costello. And they were cool. And Nick was especially affable. Dave was a little more formal. And so then I saw Nick again. We played Farm Aid in Dallas in 91, and that's when Little Village was happening, right? And I was backstage talking to Nick. And so then many years pass, you know, and I'm friends with Low Straight Jackets, you know, basically my original drummer, Jimmy Lester, helped start that band. And they were based out of here for a long time, and still kind of am. So, you know, Low Straight Jackets and Nick Lowe wound up with the same management. Now they've done a lot of music together. And in the meantime, I'd gotten to know Mac, you know, and so there were, Nick did that Christmas album, which is really good. This is just a few years ago. And the tour was set up to be Nick, Low Straight Jackets backing Nick up, and Ian McLagan opening the show solo, because he's a pianist and storyteller, raconteur, it would be great. And then he was going to sit in with them, and they were all looking forward to it. And I had just seen him in September of that year at Americana Fest, and he had come to my gig, and I had come to his, and there's a picture of us together backstage, and a friend of mine was at the table with Mac while we were playing, and he said Mac was cheering us on, going like, Webb, I love you, mate. And that I can't tell you how much that means to me.
That's so cool.
So anyway, that's September. And then by December, those Low Straight Jackets dates with Nick Lowe are supposed to happen. It's a holiday thing. Mac died, 69.
Yeah,
so it's a bummer, you know? And so, but being bereft and practical and scrambling and hustling like I always have to do, I know Jake Guralnick, who manages Low Straight Jackets. And I said, Jake, I hate that this is, you can't imagine how much I hate that this happened to Mac, because I loved him, but who's going to open these shows? And I wound up opening two of those shows.
Oh, that's very cool.
So,
good hustle.
Then I see Nick, and he goes, well, Webb, when was the last time we saw each other? You know? And I said, well, I hate to tell you, Nick, I think it was like 1991 at Farm Aid, you know? And he goes, I thought it'd been sooner than that. So Nick is unbelievably eloquent and everything. So he goes out the first night, and he would do some songs solo before he brought the band out. And he said something, he did a song, and then he said, it's great to be here tonight, but, you know, it's somewhat bittersweet, because we were so looking forward to Ian McLagan opening the shows tonight. And, you know, he was really what used to be called a groover back in the day. And also Webb Wilder and Webb and I have, we go back to the 1970s. because I told him about meeting him in the record store. And I don't know, to me, that was hilarious.
That's
and,
pretty funny.
And I think the next night he said the same thing, but he goes, and Webb and I've got foam, you know, and he made a bigger deal of our previous relationship than it really was, but it was very cool to be around him.
What was Farm Aid like? How many, that was like, how many hundreds of thousands of people were there?
Well, there were a lot. And as the day went on, the crowd swelled. So I don't know how many we played for, but this was 1991. We had a major label record deal on Zoo, which was a BMG label. And we had this song that was my biggest hit, Tough It Out, got national airplay. And, you know, something like number 11 on Billboard's Modern Rock Tracks chart at the time. So there was a very powerful DJ in Dallas named Redbeard, and he had just added it or something. And Farm Aid was in Dallas, and we were somewhere, and Zoo wrote the tour support check and flew us, you know, on a jet to Dallas. And so we get there, and you're shaking hands with people like, you know, Kris Kristofferson and Nils Lofgren. I gave him a CD of Doodad, and, you know, Roseanne Barr was there, you know, and stuff, and all these people. And, you know, John Mellencamp was on the bill, and it was just crazy. And so our label had spent a fortune flying us out there. We had a big record at Dallas Radio that week. We were allotted two songs. They cut our set in half. So we did Tough It Out through some rented Marshalls with no sound check. And we're just like, wow, we're loud. And, got off stage, and then they wanted everybody to leave because of some kind of a ticket thing or seat thing. And I'm like, you're kidding. You know, we come out here and we play your show for free, and now you're making us leave so we can't hang out. And I was kind of mad about it, you know.
Yeah, that is not cool.
And somebody gave me Waylon's place in the deal because he had flown home or something. And my band had to go back to the hotel, and I got to stay and, you know, do things like talk to Jim Keltner and Ry Cooter and Nick Lowe and see my friend David Grissom play with Mellencamp. But anyway, talking to those other guys was great. And Ry Cooter, talking to him was great, you know.
Yeah, that's so cool. I can't believe they wanted to boot you guys out. That's kind of,
to this day, I really resent that. And that's the kind of stuff that I've had overcoming that kind of, I don't know if I've ever overcome it, but one of the things about the music business that really bothers me is I don't think I'm, you know, the cat's pajamas, and I don't think I'm a piece of crap, but that's the way it is. You know, one, it's like, Webb, you're greater. Huh? Webb who? No, I don't think so. Next.
Yeah, you know,
You're never just, you're never really, sure of where you stand, you know, because it's smoke blown up your ass or in your face.
But I know, you know, I think that's like, that's just the nature of business in general, I think, sometimes.
I guess so.
You know, it's with rare exception, it's, you know, it's funny, I've been working for myself 20 years. My wife came home the other day and said a friend of hers, who's probably been working for the same company for 20 years, just lost his job. And, you know, he's in his, probably a little older than me. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, people think working for yourself is dangerous, but man, that is scary. Cause I mean, he, you know, I don't know what skills the guy has or anything, but that's got, you know, I felt really bad. That's a tough position. And so that reminds me I thought of that when you were talking about all this. It's like, it's not just the music business. It's just how it is sometimes, I think.
Oh, you know, the typical, there's a, you know, it's a cliche of like a guy who's worked for a company for all these years and he's just about to hit retirement and, you know, access his benefits and they lay him off 90 days prior or something.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they did with this guy, actually. So, oddly enough. Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes.
Sure. My favorite.
Your favorite, man. What's your go-to guitar right now and what other two guitars would round out your top three?
Well, it depends, but if you're talking live or studio, and more of my life has historically been live than studio. So having owned some really great guitars, some of which I have, some of which I don't anymore, I'm almost embarrassed to tell you what my go-to guitar is, but it so functions and it's such a workhorse and I've played it so long, I'm so used to it. My go-to live guitar, I've probably owned it more years than I realize now. I've owned it probably 15 years or something. And it's a Mexican 72. It's a reissue. It's a Mexican reissue of a 72 Tele Deluxe. And, you know, when those guitars came out in the 70s, like most 70s Fenders, I didn't like them. And I didn't like those original wide range humbuckers because I didn't know that much. And I thought, well, they don't sound like Gibson humbuckers, therefore they failed. Well, that's the point I missed. They were great. They were their own thing. You know, you think, well, you know, you got the great Tele pickups and the Rickenbacker toaster tops and the Gretsch Filtertrons and the Dynasonics and the classic PAF and the classic P90. That's it. You know, there's one more, and it's the original wide range humbuckers, which if you get one of those old guitars, they're really not great guitars because they kind of got awful finish and skinny necks and stuff. But you plug one in and it's got this piano like, if you get a good one, clarity. And nobody's ever been able to nail that again. And a lot of people are trying. And I went down the rabbit hole of finding out why. And the pole pieces are actually magnets, and they're made of this substance that I'm not sure I can pronounce, called kunife or something. And they're threaded pole pieces. And so anyway, when they reissued this guitar from Mexico, it was pretty much just like the original, lots of bad polyester finish, you know, but the pickups were okay, but they were pale imitation. So I set about modding it to my preferences, and later found out they've kind of come out with a model that is like what I modded mine to be, which is the Chris Shiflett model.
Yep.
So it's, mine's got, you know, it's got titanium saddles, because George Bradfield said to try them, and I put them on there and never changed them. I guess they're okay. I converted it to a 4-bolt neck. I took off one of the string trees. I put a round string tree, and then I put Seymour Duncan humbucker. Well, I got a whole new pick guard made. I eliminated one pot, went to 3 instead of 4. And I got, you know, the cool thing, Duncan has a lot of cool stuff, but they have that Trembucker series where you can get a fender spaced humbucker for the bridge, so everything lines up right. So I got the Alnico 2 Trembucker in the bridge and the Seth Lover in the neck. And you know, then we start using the guitar. It's got real big frets. At first I thought, well, these are like heavy metal. They're great. They're just like luxurious bends, you know. And it's just got this awful finish on the body. If it was a nitro body, it would ring a little more. So it's not a great studio guitar, but man, it's a great blues lead guitar. And the whole thing of having two humbuckers on a Tele is kind of the best of both worlds. You know, you get all the Tele stability and long scale. I tune a half step flat, but then you get that fat humbucker thing, and it's not quite as chocolate as it might be on a mahogany guitar. So set neck. So that's a real go-to thing. And then I have another Partsicaster that should not be good. I've got this theory that you can do everything wrong and still get a good guitar. You can do everything right and still not get a good guitar.
Yeah.
So I've got this Partsicaster. The body is a Suhr, S-U-H-R.
Yep.
And the guy is real light, and it's some kind of unique chambered sandwich construction. It's ash. It's very resonant, and it's got an acrylic finish. It's strat contoured from the factory, but it got broken. And this guy gave it to me. I said, why don't you just get it fixed? He goes, I'm just going to get another body from Suhr. I was like, all right, great, thanks. So I had it glued back together, and I had Jeff Sinn work on it, and I had a Saga neck from many years ago. And Jeff calls me, and he goes, man, this thing is not like Fender specs. I'm going to have to make a wooden shim to go between the neck and the body. And I was like, oh, boy. That guitar sounds great. I've got
done
trailing
like
pickups
major
in
major work on your guitars.
Oh yeah, I'm that guy. Anna, except I don't do it myself, so it cost me a fortune. I've got a pile of them that need refretting right now. But anyway, that guitar rings like a bell, and what I've mainly used it for is my open E flat, which is like open E, it's just a half step flat, for a few songs. But it sounds so good, and it's so light, and my back is so bad now, I'm trying to work it into a different slot. But the only other guitar I have that sounds really good in that open E thing is my old 50s Murphy refinished TV Junior.
Oh, wow.
And it needs refretting, but not for playing open tuning. So I don't know. And then I've got a bunch of other guitars, some of which record good. That Coronet sounds fantastic. It's got lots of harmonic complexity, but it's got that 61 neck, you know, that's a little thin from top to back. And I'm kind of a rambunctious live player, and then you have the short scale tuning it flat. It's
You're a big guy too, great. If I remember correctly, right? You're pretty tall. You're a pretty tall guy, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I'm a tall guy. And the V looks good on better on a big guy, you know. And I take that out about every fifth gig, you know. And it's got Voodoo pickups. Otherwise, it's pretty stock. And it's a great guitar. I love that guitar. And I've got, you know, some other guitars. I've got an R8 Gibson Les Paul that Murphy refinished. And it's got the Greg Martin pickups that a friend of mine gave me. And I really like that. And I recorded some with that on the Mississippi Modern album.
That's great. His sound is amazing. You're lucky. I didn't know they had those pickups outside of in his guitars.
Oh, no, it's an R.S. Fralin Aged. It's some kind of collaboration between Fralin and R.S. Guitar Works in Kentucky. I guess they're still making them.
Interesting.
In fact, I think they call them Psychabilly.
That's a good name.
Which is kind of weird. But we have a mutual friend, Gary Bohannon, and Gary gave me those pickups. And Gary's an expert on vintage stuff and who makes the best reissue stuff and all. And I can't remember what I had in there prior, but that's a real good guitar. And I had an R7 and I had another R8. And there's something that has to be right in the wood of a set neck guitar or any guitar really for the pickups to give up the goods of the harmonic complexity and all. Some guitars I've noticed you plug them in, they just go doink. It's just a focused note. And I like the sparklers going off, you know. Mm. And I had an old double cut TV Junior that's on the back of the Acres of Suede album that really did that. And I had to sell it when I had horses to build a fence.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, the Coronet does that. It doesn't have the big, nice neck like that one had, but it does all that. And Dave Henson, you know, killer vintage, he told me a lot of times the Coronets beat the Juniors.
You've mentioned Acres of Suede a couple of times. That is a really cool title. Give me the backstory to that.
Well, it's a little embarrassing, but I'll tell you, I have really long feet. You know, if I go into a shoe store and they measure my foot, it's a 13.5 double A, very narrow and long. And so New Balance is the only athletic shoe company that makes the real narrow width. And so, you know, you don't have a lot of choice. And I've worn those gray suede New Balance running shoes a lot. And we were in the studio in the 90s with Bobby Field, who's basically a genius. And he goes, "Damn, where'd you get those Acres of Suede?"
That's so funny.
Yeah, and then that became the album title.
That's great, man. That is hilarious. Acres of Suede. I like. There's always a cool story, you know. Usually with like an unconventional or sort of like, wacky, title. There's always some sort of cool story behind that.
Yeah. About Time, we shouldn't have called that album About Time, because we found out later that Steve Winwood had done an album called that. And I didn't want to call this new album Powerful Stuff, but Michael Rothschild at Landslide insisted. And so we did. But the T-Birds had done that song, even though we were maybe the first band to ever do it, because Bobby wrote it with some other guys. I just didn't want to call it that. And they'd had a hit with the song, and they'd called an album that. But he said, "That's 30 years ago." And it's like, well, what you don't realize is in the roots rock circle, 30 years ago is the second. Look at people still quoting Howlin' Wolf and Chuck Berry, you know.
I hear you, man. What was the first record? No, it wasn't CD. What was the first record you ever purchased, if you remember that?
I don't know. I could theorize. I know some of the very early 45s and EPs I got, but I do specifically remember. And that's that funny thing of, I was just into music. Like I say, in the fourth grade, you know, all the cool people and all the uncool people liked the Beatles, and I wasn't that popular. So I was keenly aware of all that. And I thought, man, these uncool people have never liked anything cool before. I wonder if the Beatles are really cool. It took me about 2 seconds to figure out they were, you know. But to answer your question, so I think it was just before that, it was maybe in the fourth grade, before the Ed Sullivan Show, that I had bought two albums through my mother, through Sears. You know, you could order records from Sears back then. And I got Rick Nelson's Million Sellers, which was a really good choice, you know, James Burton on every track. And then the other one was kind of cheesy. I, you know, like so many people, you know, you're just blown away with Elvis no matter what. And I didn't know the movies were basically bad. I was a kid. And so I had seen that it happened at the World's Fair Elvis movie and thought it was kind of cool. And so that was one of the albums you could order from Sears. So those two came in one package. It was Elvis Presley, It Happened at the World's Fair, and Rick Nelson's Million Sellers.
Very cool, man. If I asked you to pick, this is a tough question, Desert Island Discs in no particular order and knowing that this can change tomorrow, what are the first three albums that come to your mind, like knee-jerk reaction?
Well, the knee-jerk reaction, for like you say, for better or worse, it could change tomorrow in no certain order, would be No Dice by Badfinger.
That's a
Live and Well by B.B. King. And I guess it's called Tear It Up, the Rock and Roll Trio album that has all the great Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio stuff on it.
That's cool, man. I have never heard any of those as an answer. That's very cool. That No Dice is a great album, man.
Well, and you know, it's been pointed out to me that the next album, Straight Up, is probably better, but it's partially just sentimentality, but those first three albums are great. And then later, I'm obviously just way into Badfinger, but later people got to pointing out that, you know, that was all Apple, but they did an album out there at the Caribou Ranch, you know, studio in Colorado for Warner Brothers called Wish You Were Here. And the good stuff on there is just really the majesty of rock. It's really great. But no, man, I tell you what, if you've never heard the classic Johnny Burnett Rock and Roll Trio stuff, you better sit down and turn it up. And it's like the most visceral, compelling first generation rock and roll there is, you know, realizing that Buddy Holly to that is like the Beatles because of the songwriting and the anti-heroic thing and the variety. But for the muscular fuck you, here it is, man, punch in the face. It's the Rock and Roll Trio. And God damn, it's just really powerful music.
Are you a fan, I would imagine, of the Blasters?
I am. And, but you know, I'm not completely well-versed in their catalog, but I was so pleased to get to do a few shows with Dave and Phil a few years ago. Since I've opened myself up to doing acoustic solo shows, you know, a few nice things like that have happened. And partly I think economics, you know, in the changing industry, there used to not be the opportunities for as many solo shows, you know, but so yeah, I am familiar with them. And Dave's solo career, who knew that he would be such a prolific songwriter? I just heard one yesterday that they played on WMOT, Roots Radio here, that I'd heard before, but it's cool, and it's called Out of Control.
You listen to radio. God bless you, man.
Well, I do, and I'll tell you one reason why is that I'm on that radio station. So I like to stay. Yeah. I do this weekly show called The List, and I like to stay abreast of what's happening.
That's very cool, man.
And it's a good channel because it's eclectic. Nashville has never had a reporting Americana station channel until the last couple of years. And I was literally one of the first satellite DJs. I mean, if they hire you before they go on the air, hey, you're one of the first. So I anchored here. Most of the people were in D.C. When XM and Sirius were separate, you know, the Americana channel here, which was called Cross Country. And my program director was an incredible lady named Jessie Scott. Well, she's my program director now, but it's a terrestrial station that's also online. It's 100,000 watts, though, terrestrially. I mean, you can leave Nashville in any direction and it'll hang with you for a good while. And then, of course, it's online, rootsradio.com. And we never had a reporting Americana channel till, which is crazy. It's Music City, and the Americana Music Association is here and has their annual event here. We didn't even have it. Knoxville has one. So it's a bit been a good thing for the community. And they play everything from, you know, Margo Price to B.B. King, you know, so that station is like one of my albums. If you don't like what you're listening, just tough it out. The next song is going to be completely different.
Yeah. You know, I think you made a point about how it's eclectic. And it now, as you're talking about this, this is the way radio used to be.
That's what I'm saying, man. And, you know, top 40 radio, when I was a kid, just prior to FM rock,
right?
FM rock came in with like the 20-minute song, you know, like Inagata DeVita and stuff, which wasn't really, in retrospect, that great. Whereas AM had the top 40, Buck Owens crossed over, Johnny Cash crossed over, you had the British Invasion, you had Motown, you had Stax.
Yep.
Even the pop schlock was all analog killer players and hooky, catchy songs. So it was really great.
No, it was. You'd have like Al Green followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by, you know, whoever, Sam and Dave.
Petula Clark, yeah. Buck Owens, right. Wilson Pickett, you know.
Yep. And that was really cool. And I hate, that's the one thing I like, sometimes I'll talk to people and I'll say, hey, and you know, we had this conversation prior, like what, I have to tell my listeners what kind of music you play. I want, you know, I got to give them some, and I hate to ask that question because it's like whatever term they come up with can be obsolete in 6 months, and it could be, or split in half or in thirds, you know? So I hate to categorize stuff.
Well, you know, I realize now that some people are born to do what they do. And I'm a big fan of theirs for doing it. Marty Stewart was born to be the standard bearer for everything that's good about country. And even he is somewhat eclectic,
yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And then Jimmy Vaughn was born to play the blues, but even he,
he's eclectic, man.
He's eclectic, but man, it all comes out pretty bluesy, and I'm a huge fan, but my deal was, I didn't know that. I thought because of the Beatles and that whole thing, I thought if you were cool, it was your duty to find out who Muddy Waters was. It was your duty to find out who Eddie Cochran was. It was your duty to try to be cool and try to do something with integrity and to know about more than one thing, you know. And even still, it's all pretty lowbrow. I don't know much about jazz. I don't know much about classical music, you know. I know about rhythm and blues and honky. I don't even know much about bluegrass. I like what I know about some of it, you know, when you get into the roots and the pioneers of it. I'm a little disappointed at times that people don't do what I did, which I also thought the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all those people encouraged you to do. If you like something, find out what those people liked and go back, you know, like, I can't believe like some of the young guys who are into blues, when people ask them their influences, they just kind of say John Mayer and Joe Bonamassa, not to knock those guys, not to knock them. But I mean, you're not even going to say B.B. King. Come on. That's like ground zero for all, if you've ever bent a string, you know.
That's funny. Yeah. One thing about your music, you just said something, and I would, you know, to feather in your cap, it is, you said you do something with integrity. When I listen to you play, when I watch you play, whether live or on YouTube, it's pure, you know. I know you are doing that with integrity. And the second adjective that comes to mind is fun. You always seem like you're really having a good time. And you're also very concerned with making sure the people listening to you have a good time. And I think that knowing that you're in the entertainment business is very important. And you clearly know that by how you interact and engage.
Well, I appreciate all that. I'm sure I fall shy of the mark on any one of those on here and there. But yeah, that all those things you're trying to do. And but I think at the core of it all, you're sort of thinking, you know, you're doing it for yourself. If I like it, then somebody else might like it. Now, that doesn't mean you're not trying to meet them in the middle by being, you know, by giving them something that you really do think they'll like, you know, or that you want to throw an entertainment component. But even some of the entertainment component, I'm entertaining myself, and that gets back to having fun, and having fun, yeah, is contagious, you know.
100%. It's infectious, contagious, all of the above, man, for sure. I read this thing in, you know, I've been in sales the last 30 something years, and I read something many years ago when I first started studying sales and stuff, and it said, he who has the most energy wins. And I think it's very true in music. You know, you come up there and you put the energy out. I am not going to say the acts because it was embarrassing, but I went to a concert a week ago with my son. There were three acts on there, and the headliner was phenomenal. First class, kicked ass, professional. And the middle act, it was the worst concert I ever saw. The lead singer got pissed off. He had a hissy fit on stage because there was a cable problem. I mean, man, you're a fucking musician. You're having a hissy fit because there's a problem with a cable? Oh my God, what are you going to do? Like when something's, you know, when you get a flat tire, you must be like, you know, I mean, seriously, I mean, that's like part of the deal.
No, you got to roll, man. I had a thing happen a couple of weekends ago. We've been playing a lot of weekends in July and August, and they might as well have been tours because the distances were really rough. You know, I mean, you know, just the routing wasn't really there. And, but the gigs have been fun. The guys I've been playing with have been fun. The fans and the crowds have been fun. But we were doing a show. Well, we had a weekend. This was not good routing. We played at a club in Lexington, Kentucky. And then the next day we're in Rocky Mount, Virginia, you know. And it's kind of, you know, you need to see a chiropractor when you get there, you know. So what we were opening for Tab Benoit. And, and you know, he draws like 300 to 500 people, apparently. And he's a nice guy. I met him. I don't know that much about him. So I use the rechargeable power supply, the Volto that that Pedal Train makes, and it's a great little product, you know. And it eliminates when you're setting up your own gear, you have no roadies. There's one less wire to run, you know. You don't have to plug it into some AC, and you just have to recharge it between gigs, you know. And it's up under your pedal board. So in Lexington, the first night, everything was going great, and my pedal board just died.
Oh man!
And so, you know, you kind of stomp on every box, nothing happens, and you somehow it comes back on, and you play that song and you take a break and you come back and it does it some more, but it comes back on, and you kind of can't make it screw up later, and you think, well, maybe it'll work tomorrow night, you know. And so we go to the Tab Benoit gig, having traveled all day, and everything's going great, and we're playing three piece both gigs, and I love playing three piece. I love playing four piece. And so I think it was right before my solo on No Great Shakes, it goes out. And so I got like 300 to 500 people out there, and I just scramble real quickly and, you know, unplug from the pedal board, plug straight in the amp. And, you know, I get to play the second half of the solo. So, I mean, I finished the set that way. And luckily my guitars, you know, were pretty in tune because they were stretched out and everything from the night before. But that guy having the hissy fit, he needed to do something like that.
Oh, Mike, he didn't just have a hissy fit. He started throwing things across the stage. I was like, man, people, you know, I was fortunate. I was given the tickets because I knew somebody playing. But, man, that was just like people spend a lot of money to go there, man, and to act like an asshole. I thought that was really poor taste. And I was a fan of the band, which really put me off them. So, but anyway.
Well, I don't know what all was going on. I mean, we've all had our weak moments. And we've all lost our temper at times and stuff. So don't want to judge anybody, but you need to try to not do stuff like that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the guy's in his 50s. He should have his shit together.
Yeah.
Most important thing, Webb, that you've learned about yourself over this entire journey?
Oh, I don't know. Probably that family of origin is just huge for all your best and worst qualities, you know, and that's not the music business. And the other thing I guess I've learned is that if you really want to play, you just better do it because you're going to come back around to it anyway and realize that that's who you are. But that's a hard thing to ascertain because it's in ratios in people. I know people who love music, who wanted to play, but maybe not bad enough to not do something else and stick with it. So I don't know, just getting to know yourself. I think the fact that you may not know yourself as well as you think when you're young, that may be one of the greatest lessons I've learned.
Yeah, man, that's very true. Best childhood memory.
Best childhood memory. Oh gosh. There are some really good ones. Let me think a minute. I have some really great memories when I was really young of going to the family reunions at what was known as the Camper Park Pavilion in Hattiesburg. And my Aunt Lillian, you know, who had the record label, and I didn't know she'd had a record label yet, was a great cook. And she'd bring their own food, you know, and you'd sample everybody's food and you'd meet relatives and stuff. And a lot of love and just that was really great. And then a little later on, I remember for a shining moment, they had a slot car track near my house. And when I was in the sixth grade, and I got into slot cars, and I was always terrible at sports. I was always never going to win anything. I actually won a slot car race. That was just like huge for me.
That is big.
And then of course, you know, seeing bands play at the teen center and playing my first, and this, by this point, you're, you know, junior high, you know, you're in your teens. And, I'm trying to think about other childhood memories. My father had some farms, you know, and I had a horse, you know, and here and there, usually that I couldn't ride. Nobody teach you about riding. I had to learn about that later on. And here's your horse. Get on him and hope for the best. And, you know. So some wonderful stuff and wonderful friends. You know, my best friend, Paul McDaniel, lived right down the street and we were really close. And I realized how important friendship would be throughout my life with various people. And it's all, you know, my dad told me when I was a kid, he said, when you get to a certain age, you'd be lucky if you, I don't remember how he phrased it. You know, you can count your friends on one hand or whatever. And, you know, there are a lot of people you're friendly with, but having people you can really count on that you respect, who respect you, and healthy relationships, that's all so important.
That's good. Are you still friends with your buddy, your best friend from school, from when you were a kid?
No, we just lost touch. We never fell out.
Yeah.
You know, and we sort of exchanged pleasantries through other people every once in a while, but we just kind of went different paths. And there was never any animosity between us, but we were really close when we were kids.
Sure, man. That definitely happens. Tell me something about yourself that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd, besides your big feet thing.
let's see. I don't like to host parties. I don't even like going to them that much.
Really? Why's that?
I don't know. I think I'm a chatty introvert at times. The whole deal of being an introvert or an extrovert, or maybe is an interesting thing to ponder. And maybe people are, you know, a little of both or something. And I don't know.
So you're extra. But, so you're. Oh no, I kind of get that. So you're extroverted in an intimate conversation per se, but you're not extroverted like the life of the party, dude. Like you're running around shaking hands and kissing babies.
Oh, I'm totally not that. I'm the guy that kind of finds a place in the kitchen and stands there. And if people want to talk to me, they can come to me and I'll talk to them one-on-one and enjoy it.
Right. No, I understand that. I totally get that. I'm not like that, but I totally get that, man.
I have a friend that passed away who was a really cool guy. Jerry Farrow Felton. And, he was from Hattiesburg and we moved to Austin in our first Austin band years ago. And he later played with Omar and the Howlers. And I stumbled on his obituary the other day and it said he actually turned down an opportunity to be in a band with Stevie Ray Vaughan. There may be some truth in that, but, I hadn't seen him in a while years ago. And I was we used to play at the old Antones on the drag in, Austin and, through several incarnations of my band, and I had a new incarnation of my band, and I was out there and he came and he was at the sound check and I said, "Hey man, come over here and meet the band." He goes, "Oh, I know enough people." And he literally wouldn't even meet them.
I know enough people.
Yeah. And I feel like that sometimes, you know. That's it's funny, just like, man. Well, I don't want to go to a party and go to people and introduce myself to them. Really? Yeah. Is that my job, you know?
You know, I used to be like that, and I've changed. I like meeting new people now. I mean, I've always liked meeting new people, but now I will proactively go out of my way to do it. And for me anyway, it's two reasons. Number one, I'm much more comfortable with myself.
See, that's the thing. I'm better about that than I once was. Getting comfortable in your own skin, getting to know yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, when I'm more comfortable with myself, then I'm much more like, you know, I'm okay just being myself, you know, talking to people. And if they don't receive me, I'm okay with that because they have that right. I don't take that personally anymore. I don't take that like, you know, it's like, okay, you know, you totally have that right, man. That's totally cool.
And, well, I'm better about it than I once was, but, and I like meeting people, but that whole thing, if you go into a whole room of them that you don't know, and it's like, really, am I going to just go around like an insurance salesman? And,
yeah, I'm not, I wouldn't do that either. That's a bit much, man. It's like too, it's too network-y. You know, I think it's good to let things happen organically.
Exactly.
You know, I always figure the guy you're next to is the guy you're supposed to be next to, and you talk. If it works out and you can have a laugh, great. If not, you know.
That's it. That's what I'm saying.
Move on. Yeah, I'm with you. Who's had the biggest influence on your life, both musically and personally?
Well, you know, a lot of those people I talked about that I loved their records or maybe saw them play live had big, you know, the Faces, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, you know, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, and all those people. But except for getting to know Ian McClagan a little bit, you know, I didn't really know any of those people. So, you know, my parents had huge influence on my life, but, you know, you really can't tell my story without talking about Bobby Field, who, like all of us, is far from perfect as a human, but he's a kind of a genius, you know, and he was from Hattiesburg, and he was a little older, and he played drums in bands, and every band he'd get in, he'd improve their set list, and was always hip to what was happening and would really read the reviews of albums in Rolling Stone and seek out, you know, things that other people didn't know about. And then he started writing songs in high school and we got to be friends. And we took our first exploratory trip to Austin together, you know, and so many things, you know, he started this band, The Howlers, which became Omar and The Howlers. And that's really on my mind a lot lately because I just went out to Austin to play in a benefit for Omar because he's in bad health. And then Bobby, you know, produced, was the first drummer in the Beatniks and produced the band and wrote songs for the band and went on to produce John Mayall and, you know, Steve Earle and tons of other people. So he turned me on to so much good music that I became a huge fan of early on because he's 2 years older, you know, and I think that was a lot of it. So probably him.
That's great, man. Good to have someone like that. Best money you ever spent on something?
Oh, wow.
Doesn't have to be music.
The Precision Bass, you know, that was good money. Even though it was my parents' money, that was good money that I spent. And
yeah, that's a huge return on that investment.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think what else.
First divorce lawyer?
I had a good one, thank God.
That was a good investment.
Or I might not have the P-Bass now. But, you know, this is a funny thing, but back to my weird feet, I think, you know, when I finally started getting boots made to measure back in the, and I haven't had the money to do it in a long time. Luckily, I've taken care of them and they've held up and I'd like to get some more. But, you know, I always liked Western stuff and I liked cowboy boots and they didn't fit, you know, and a pair of cowboy boots that doesn't fit is one of the least comfortable things you could wear. And a pair that really fits is one of the most comfortable things you can wear.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as expensive as they were, I think that was money well spent. And so, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on other stuff, but,
no, that's a great, you know what? Cause sometimes you come across little things in life that are like, some people might find them like weird, but like something like that, boots to measure, but it really, you know, it's like a little guilty pleasure you have. I'm all for that. I think people, we all need to indulge ourselves a little better. You know, I think most people that I know, especially if you have a good work ethic and you're demanding of yourself, you may not do that often enough.
Yeah.
You know, then you get the flip side where guys do that shit to excess. It's like, you know, every week is a new freaking guitar or whatever. But
yeah,
but that's not, you know, that's, I think, the minority. I think the majority are just like, you know, sort of like hardworking stiffs and, you know, put their head down every day and just do what they do. And I think little things like that are really cool.
Well, something that you buy that you get a lot of use or enjoyment out of that lasts, you know, like those boots or like that P-Bass or like even that black Tele Deluxe thing, you know, I've used the tar out of that, you know, and it as a snob, you know, it's kind of like beneath me because I love Fender, but it's not one of their up the food chain products, you know.
Sure.
It's just kind of an ignoble mass produced thing. But golly, I'm sure, you know, and I bought it retail, you know, and I'm modded the hell out of it. But it was money well spent because I've used it for more years than I can remember now, you know?
I totally get it, man. My thing is I like good coffee and I like cigars and I like not super expensive, but I like to smoke a nice cigar. I don't do them often enough. And that's my sort of like little indulgence. I love to just sit down with coffee or iced tea and just do nothing and smoke a cigar.
Well, I'm a coffee guy. And, you know, if I had plenty of money, I'd probably be a car guy, too, because I'm a stuff guy. I mean, the older I get, I realize that, well, you might need to start getting rid of some stuff instead of amassing it. But, you know, I had an old 53 Chevy truck many years ago, and I had an MG. And I don't know anything about fixing them or mechanics, but I like cars and guitars and amps and clothes and all that stuff. So I'm a little material. I'm a Taurus, and supposedly, you know, being a lover of fine things.
Taurus, that's what.
I'm born on the cusp of Gemini, so I'm a mixed up bull. That's what I tell people.
I hear that. Yeah, man. If you want to try a good coffee, like my favorite coffee is Stumptown, and they have this brand. It's a blend called Holler Mountain. Man, I love it. It's a little
okay,
pricey.
I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah, it's pricey. That's like once or twice a year I'll buy a couple of them, but it's really good. Stumptown Holler Mountain, man, it's great coffee. And whenever I'm in New York or wherever I see a Stumptown, I'll grab one.
So do they have coffee shops or you just have to buy it at a
store? No, they have coffee shops and they're also in restaurants, but usually they're in like super highbrow restaurants.
Yeah.
That I don't go to. Just I'm like, you know, give me a slice of pizza or I'm either eating, you know, like low key or like going to a place where they have something I could drink. But
well, and occasionally, you know, you'll have a meal in a restaurant that's just great. We just played, believe it or not, we just played Natalie's Coal Fired Pizza, which is a place a lot of people play that are hip in Columbus, Ohio. And their pizza is like kind of a religious experience, man. It's just super good. You know, that's, we got it for free because we're playing there. But I mean, it would have been money well spent if I had bought it, you know.
Is that a chain or is it like just one shop?
I think it's a one-off place, you know, and the guy that owns it and his daughter, Natalie, who owns it, are big music fans, you know. It's That's in really Columbus, cool. Ohio.
I've never been there. I would definitely check it out if I'm up that way, man.
There are two pizza places that are legendary in New Haven, Connecticut that split off from the same family, and I can't remember the names of them, but there have been things on television about them, and I've never eaten there, and I want to. But, you know, speaking of coffee, back in the 80s, 90s, I found out about that Hawaiian Kona coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great, but it's like way expensive.
It's crazy expensive. I got married in Hawaii, and that's when we got turned on to it. And but it's like, you know, $35-$40 for 12 ounces now. It's really,
I know. I mean, it's off my list. I can't do it.
It's just a hard time to justify it, spending $40 on 12 ounces of coffee. I mean, it's great. So we got to. I have a bunch of miles. I'm going to go back there at some point.
I like Starbucks iced coffee. I've not had any better iced coffee than theirs. I get the cold brew, and I've spent so much money at Starbucks. They ought to give me stock in the company.
There you go. They name a wing after you. No, now, let me tell you what's going to happen about this show. Well, I'm going to get a mixed bag of mail. I'm going to get some people hating this. Oh, all you guys did was fucking talk about coffee. And then I'm going to get other people say, hey, that was really cool that you talked about a bunch of stuff. I like coffee too. And thanks for turning me on. It's so funny as we're talking about, it's like, you can't make everybody happy. You know, it's just quite funny. Like somebody sent me a comment, I don't know, a while ago. And they were like, all this guy did was talk about what concerts the guy went to. And I was like, yeah, well, they were in the fucking 60s. He saw Hendrix and Rock.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm going to talk about that. Like, he saw Hendrix and Zeppelin. That's pretty damn cool to me. So
I saw Ray Charles. I saw Delaney and Bonnie. I saw The Faces. I saw Badfinger. I saw The Stones. And I saw The Eagles. And I saw Jethro Tull. And I saw Martha Hoople. I saw The Band. And I wish I'd seen more, you know. But when I saw The Stones, it was kind of the ultimate. I mean, it would have been great to see the Brian Jones era Stones, but, sure. You know, the Mick Taylor era Stones was really pretty strong. And so Exile was the new album. Stevie Wonder was the opening act.
Stevie Wonder and the Rolling Stones?
I'm looking at the poster that I bought at the show framed on my wall right now.
Crazy, man.
1972, they opened with Brown Sugar, Mick Taylor and Keith Richards. I mean, come on.
That's the best era of the Stones for me, in my opinion, musically. I think Mick Taylor, it was no finer guitar player than Mick Taylor when he was with the Stones.
Well, and you know, those guys complemented each other so uncannily good. Yeah. And Mick Taylor was one of those guys who could make overplaying sound great. Yeah, and at the great. Same time, not really step on Keith. It was amazing.
Yeah, I love his. But to me, that his work in Can't You Hear Me Knocking is just about the best tracks ever laid down, man, guitar-wise.
And there are times when he's playing great rhythm behind Keith and his slide playing. Come on.
Slide playing was nuts, man. Hey, do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
No, not really. You know, at one time I had horses and I was really into that. And I still enjoy cowboyography kind of, you know, reading and things. But I... It's pretty much reading in old movies. You know, my girlfriend and I really like to watch Turner movie classics. I've become a huge Myrna Loy fan.
That's
and so, you know, I think it would be healthy. But, you know, I'm an obsessive guy. And I'm such an all or nothing guy. When I did the horse thing, I realized, you know, it's a weekend thing and playing the music's a weekend thing. And they're kind of at cross purposes, you know, and I think the real horseman, the real cowboys and all, they've got their spirituality there. And a musician's got his spirituality caught up in being a musician. And I don't know how people really do both. I know Lyle Lovett, you know, competes in horse stuff and all. And he stays so busy with his music. I don't know how he ever does that, you know?
Yeah, that's horses. It's like boats, man. It's not like, you know, it's a lot of work. It's not a 5-minute thing.
I'm glad I did it. It was really expensive, and they went with the divorce, which was good because I wouldn't have been able to keep it up, and I somehow didn't get hurt very bad because they say if you ride, you're going to fall, you know, and I just have one crooked finger to show. Everything else is pretty okay, and that finger works fine, but you know, horses are afraid of two things that move and things that don't.
That's it, just those two things.
And I read somewhere where there's never been such a thing as a brave horse.
Hey man, two more questions. I appreciate your time. First is there like a specific experience that you had that changed your life or altered the way you think about things that you could talk about?
Well, I mean, I know I'm a broken record, but one of them, and I always tell people this, was seeing the Faces in 71 because I loved the records and then I saw the band and they were so like that and they were so informal. But larger than life, there was a glam factor, you know, and they were anti-heroic and theatrical at the same time. And it was so rootsy, you know, and Rod Stewart then was very cool. And it really shaped a lot of my aesthetics. And other than that, I mean, there were a lot of experiences like the time I spent with my father, you know, in the pickup truck going to the farm and things like that were really important. And, you know, that first band that moved to Austin together, we all lived in a house together. Those were really, and being around the Austin scene then in the 70s,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it was, this is funny. I had been up here in Nashville. I'd been a college student and I'd kind of gotten hip to, I was getting hip to progressive country because, you know, Pete Ham hung himself.
Yep.
The Faces broke up. Paul Kossoff died. All these things were happening to rock and roll, including disco was happening to rock and roll. And there's great stuff was bubbling up as progressive country, despite the fact that Graham Parsons had died. His album, Grievous Angel, was, you know, very in your face. And John Prine and Jesse Winchester and Amy Lou and all this quality stuff and Jerry Jeff and Waylon and Willie and all. And I was getting interested in that. And then we went out to Austin and realized that it was like an art colony where you could do anything. You know, Bobby Field and I went in this, what they called a kicker bar, the Split Rail, and saw this band, Rick Stein and the Alley Cat Band. And there they are in a cowboy bar playing a song by the Bo Brummels. And we said, we're moving here. So I moved my band out there in January of 76 and we're going down the drag. And to this day, there's a Pizza Hut right at the end where Martin Luther King and Guadalupe butt into each other. And the Pizza Hut marquee said, welcome progressive country fans. And I looked at the other guys and go, we missed it. We're too late. Cause by the time it gets to the Pizza Hut marquee, you know,
you're not
at the top of the trend. And what was taken off was the original Antones on 6th Street. I met Jimmy Vaughn. They hadn't made a record. I saw the T-Birds. They'd never made a record, but they were cool. They were totally larger than life, you know? So being around that art colony, kind of doing music for art's sake and with integrity, as opposed to trying to, you know, predict the market like Nashville, you know, and get it on the radio. I mean, I saw Stevie Ray's playing sax lines on his Strat with Paul Ray and the Cobras. They're doing sweet soul music, you know. But then it was early for all that, and there was just so much Texas, you know, the legacy and the roots of the dance halls and Bob Wills and the blues and T-Bone Walker and the affluence of Texas and all those things, you know, and the fact that Austin was unique to the rest of Texas. So that's a long-winded answer, but those were some of the things that made a big impact on me.
Did you know Denny Freeman?
I knew him later. You know, he was so nice to us. He, when kind of what's thought of as my original band with Donnie Roberts, the Twangler on guitar, and Jimmy Lester on drums and Cletus on bass, we would play that second version of Antone's on the drag. And Clifford was live and his office was there full of vintage gear and everything. Denny would come to those shows, and it was very kind to me. And so, and I saw him play. He was the other guy with Paul Ray. He was standing there next to Stevie playing horn lines on his Strat back then. And when Jimmy Vaughn did his first solo tour, Denny was playing with him, and we exchanged some pleasantries.
That's cool. I got him coming on the show like a week or two or something like that. And he was a very nice guy to talk with up front, real mellow.
Well, tell him hello. And then he played with Dylan. You know, I never knew him that well, but I really respected him, and he was very nice to me.
I will. I'm making a note here. I'll definitely tell him. And last question, Webb, and I really appreciate your time and sincerity. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this has been a deliberate change, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've become somewhat more humble over the years, and I think getting sober in 89 was the beginning of seeing myself as I really am, you know, for my pluses and minuses. And I don't know if she knows this, but my girlfriend, Dana, I think meeting her made me see that sometimes my default setting was negative. And I think I'm turning that around a little bit, and I'm realizing that you don't have to be, your first reaction to everything doesn't have to be cynicism, you know.
Sure.
And the world is full of positive and negative people, and you need to try to gravitate toward the positive ones.
That's awesome, man. And congratulations on 29 years of sobriety. That is a major fucking accomplishment. Good for you, man.
Well, that's you know, I mean, I had hit a rock bottom, so that's why I did it. But in my mind, it was a rock bottom. But I think doing it was, you know, the best thing I ever did.
I've talked to, and I both on the show and in my personal life, I know tons of guys who've gotten sober, and you know, it's there is no other bottom, you know, but the rock bottom. So congratulations. That's really good. I'm happy for you.
Well, thanks.
Hey, I just, first of all, thank you again. I really appreciate your time, and I really enjoyed talking with you, and I want to tell people where to find you. Please check out Webb Wilder. It's Webb, W-E-B-B, Wilder, W-I-L-D-E-R. Great places. He's got tons of really cool videos on YouTube. Go to his website, webwilder.com, and please check out his new album. It's called Powerful Stuff. You could buy that on Amazon or on webwilder.com. He's also touring. He's got his touring schedule up on his website, and I know you're doing some solo acoustic gigs in October.
Yep.
That will be available, and he's just a really – when you see a Webb Wilder show, he's having it, like I said, he's having a good time out there. This is not a hard thing for me to pitch. He's a nice, soulful player. He plays, as he said, roots music, rockabilly, blues. You know, he's just going to get up there and have a fun time. And I'll tell you one thing, he's giving you 110%, and that is nothing that you can't question that. He's out there laying it on the table, man. And I appreciate that. And I know everybody else does that comes to see you play at your shows, man.
Thank you, Craig. Wow. If you ever want a gig as a publicist, give me a call.
I can't. You know what? I could never do that job because, like, and I know that I'll get troll mail from publicists. Like, 4 out of 5 of those guys don't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like you call them and, hey, yeah, I want you to interview this guy. Okay. And then you never fucking hear from him again. And that's like, I hate that. Don't waste my time. You know, you can't make more time. Just tell me to fuck off that you're not interested. I'm so okay with that, you know?
Right.
Anyway, I digress. Come check out Web Wilder and support his music. He's a great guy. He's been doing this a long time. He's got 10 records. Go check him out. Buy his stuff. Enjoy it. And if you see him on tour, let him know you heard his interview and what a cool dude he is. Web, thanks very much. I hope I run into you again. And I'll see you next year at NAMM where you get to sit in with three songs with the Time Jumpers.
I hope so, for all those things.
If we both live long enough, we'll see you play for a whole set, like I said.
Killer.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate everything. Everybody, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Web Wilder for spending time with us and for sharing stories and being so candid. Make sure you go to everyoneloveguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list right now. And remember, this is really important. Happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.